Terenna Wingreen Fief was my first editor at Transline. It was her idea to title the book The Dying Earth. A records search showed a novel by that name 500 years earlier, but the copyright had lapsed and the book was out of print. It was her idea to publish just the sections of the Kantos which dealt with the nostalgic final days of Old Earth. And it was her idea to remove the sections which she thought would bore the readers. The philosophical passages, the descriptions of my mother, the sections which paid homage to earlier poets, the places where I played with experimental verse, the more personal passages. Everything, in fact, except the descriptions of the idyllic final days, which, emptied of all heavier freight, came across as sentimental and insipid. 4 months after publication, The Dying Earth had sold 2.5 billion hardfax copies. An abridged and digitalized version was available on the Seething Datasphere, and it had been optioned for the Hollies. Terenna pointed out that the timing had been perfect, that the original trauma shock of the death of Old Earth had meant a century of denial, almost as if Earth had never existed, followed by a period of revived interest culminating in the Old Earth nostalgia cults, which could now be found on every world in the web. A book, even a book of verse, dealing with the final days, had struck at precisely the right moment. For me, the first few months of life as a celebrity in the hegemony were far more disorienting than my earlier transition from spoiled son of Old Earth to enslaved stroke victim on Heaven's Gate. During those first months, I did book and fax signing on more than 100 worlds. I appeared on the All Net Now show with Marmon Hamlet. I met CEO Sinister Perot and All Things speaker Drury Fine, as well as a score of senators. I spoke to the Interplanetary Society of Penwomen and to the Lussus Writers Union. I was given honorary degrees at the University of New Earth and at Cambridge, too. I was feted, interviewed, imaged, reviewed favorably, bioed, unauthorized, lionized, serialized, and swindled. It was a busy time. Notes for a sketch of life in the hegemony. My home has 38 rooms on 36 worlds. No doors. The arched entrances are Farcaster portals. A few opaqued with privacy curtains. Most open to observation and entry. Each room has windows everywhere, and at least 2 walls with portals. From the grand dining hall on Renaissance Vector, I can see the bronze skies and the verdigris towers of Keep Enable in the valley below my volcanic peak. And by turning my head, I can look through the Farcaster portal and across the expanse of white carpet in the formal living area to see the Edgar Allan Sea crash against the spires of Point Prospero on Nevermore. My library looks out on the glaciers and green skies of Nordholm, while a walk of 10 paces allows me to descend a short stairway to my tower study, a comfortable, open room encircled by polarized glass, which offers a 360-degree view of the highest peaks of the Kushpat Karakoram, a mountain range 2,000 kilometers from the nearest settlement in the easternmost reaches of the Jamnu Republic on Deneb Dry. The huge sleeping room Helenda and I share rocks gently in the boughs of a 300-meter world tree on the Templar world of God's Grove, and connects to a solarium which sits alone on the arid salt flats of Hebron. Not all of our views are of wilderness. The media room opens to a skimmer pad on the 138th floor of a Tau Ceti Center arc tower, and our patio lies on a terrace overlooking the market in the old section of bustling New Jerusalem. The architect, a student of the legendary Milan de Havre, has incorporated several small jokes into the house's design. The steps go down to the tower room, of course, but equally droll is the exit from the area which leads to the exercise room on the lowest level of Lussus's deepest hive. Or perhaps the guest bathroom, which consists of toilet, bidet, sink, and shower stall on an open, wall-less raft afloat on the violet sea world of Mare Infinitus. At first, the shifts in gravity from room to room were disturbing, but I soon adapted, subconsciously bracing myself for the drag of Lussus and Hebron and Sol Draconi Septim, unconsciously anticipating the less than one standard G freedom of the majority of the rooms. In the 10 standard months Helenda and I are together, we spend little time in our home, preferring instead to move with friends among the resorts and vacation arcologies and night spots of the world web. Our friends are the former Farcaster set, now calling themselves the Caribou Herd, after an extinct Old Earth migratory mammal. This herd consists of other writers, a few successful visual artists, concourse intellectuals, all-thing media representatives, a few radical arnists and cosmetic gene splicers, web aristocrats, wealthy Farcaster freaks and flashback addicts, a few Holly and stage directors, scattering of actors and performance artists, several mafia dons gone straight, and a revolving list of recent celebrities, myself included. Everyone drinks, uses stims and auto implants, takes the wire and can afford the best drugs. The drug of choice is flashback. It is definitely an upper-class vice. One needs the full range of expensive implants to fully experience it. Helenda has seen to it that I have been so fitted. Biomonitors, sensory extenders, an internal comm log, neural shunts, kickers, metacortex processors, blood chips, RNA tapeworms. My mother wouldn't have recognized my insides. I try flashback twice. The first time is a glide. I target my 9th birthday party and hit it with the first salvo. It is all there. The servants singing on the north lawn at daybreak. Don Balthazar grudgingly canceling classes so I can spend the day with Amalfi in my EMV. Streaking across the gray dunes of the Amazon basin in gay abandon. A torchlight procession that evening, as representatives of the other old families arrive at dusk, their brightly wrapped presents gleaming under the moon, and the 10,000 lights. I rise from 9 hours in flashback with a smile on my face. The second trip almost kills me. I am 4 and crying, seeking my mother through endless rooms, smelling of dust and old furniture. Android servants seek to console me, but I shake off their hands, running down hallways soiled with shadows and the soot of too many generations. Breaking the first rule I ever learned, I throw open the doors to Mother's sewing room, her sanctum sanctorum, to which she retires for 3 hours every afternoon, and from which she emerges with her soft smile, the hem of her pale dress whispering across the carpet, like an echo of a ghost's sigh. Mother is sitting there, in the shadows. I am 4, and my finger has been hurt, and I rush to her, throwing myself into her arms. She does not respond. One of her elegant arms remains reclined along the back of the chaise lounge, the other remains limp on the cushion. I pull back, shocked by her cool plasticity. I tug open the heavy velvet drapes without rising from her lap. Mother's eyes are white, rolled back in her head. Her lips are slightly open. Drool moistens the corners of her mouth and glints on her perfect chin. From the gold threads of her hair, done up in the grand dame style she favors, I see the cold steel gleam of the stim wire and the duller sheen of the skull socket she has plugged it into. The patch of bone on either side is very white. On the table, near her left hand, lies the empty flashback syringe. The servants arrive and pull me away. Mother never blinks. I am pulled, screaming, from the room. I wake, screaming. Perhaps it was my refusal to use flashback again which hastened Helena's departure, but I doubt it. I was a toy to her, a primitive who amused her by my innocence about a life she had taken for granted for many decades. Whatever the case, my refusal to flashback left me with many days without her. The time spent in replay is real time, and flashback users often die, having spent more days of their lives under the drug than they ever experienced conscious. At first, I entertained myself with the implants and techno-toys which had been denied to me as a member of an old Earth family. The datasphere was a construct delight that first year. I called up information almost constantly, living in a frenzy of full interface. I was as addicted to raw data as the caribou herd were to their stims and drugs. I could imagine Don Balthazar spinning in his molten grave as I gave up long-term memory for the transient satisfaction of implant omniscience. It was only later that I felt the loss. Fitzgerald's Odyssey, Woo's Final March, and a score of other epics, which had survived my stroke, now were shredded like cloud fragments in a high wind. Much later, freed of implants, I painstakingly learned them all again. For the first and only time in my life, I became political. Days and nights would pass with me monitoring the Senate on Farcaster cable, or lying tapped into the All-Thing. Someone once estimated that the All-Thing deals with about 100 active pieces of hegemony legislation per day, and during my months spent screwed into the sensorium, I missed none of them. My voice and name became well known on the debate channels. No bill was too small, no issue too simple or too complex for my input. The simple act of voting every few minutes gave me a false sense of having accomplished something. I finally gave up the political obsession only after I realized that accessing the All Thing regularly meant either staying home or turning into a walking zombie. A person constantly busy accessing on his implants makes a pitiful sight in public. And it didn't take Helena's derision to make me realize that if I stayed home, I would turn into an all-thing sponge like so many millions of other slugs around the web. So, I gave up politics. But by then, I had found a new passion. Religion. I joined religions. Hell, I helped create religions. The Zen Gnostic Church was expanding exponentially, and I became a true believer, appearing on HTV talk shows and searching for my places of power with all the devoutness of a pre-Hijra Muslim pilgrimaging to Mecca. Besides, I loved farcasting. I had earned almost 100 million marks from royalties for the dying Earth, and Helena had invested well. But someone once figured that a Farcaster home such as mine cost more than 50,000 marks a day just to keep in the web, and I did not limit my Farcasting to the 36 worlds of my home. Transline Publishing had qualified me for a gold universal card, and I used it liberally, far-casting to unlikely corners of the web, and then spending weeks staying in luxury accommodations and leasing EMVs to find my places of power in remote areas of backwater worlds. I found none. I renounced Zen Gnosticism about the same time Helena divorced me. By that time, the bills were piling up, and I had to liquidate most of the stocks and long-term investments remaining to me after Helena had taken her share. I was not only naive and in love when she had had her attorneys draw up the marriage contract, I was stupid. Eventually, even with such economies as cutting down my farcasting and dismissing the android servants, I was facing financial disaster. I went to see Terenna Wingreen Fief. "No one wants to read poetry," she said, leafing through the thin stack of cantos I had written in the past year and a half. "What do you mean?" I said. "The Dying Earth was poetry." "The Dying Earth was a fluke," said Terenna. Her nails were long and green and curved in the latest Mandarin fashion. They curled around my manuscript like the claws of some chlorophyll beast. "It sold because the mass subconscious was ready for it." "Well, maybe the mass subconscious is ready for this," I said. I was beginning to get angry. Terenna laughed. It was not an altogether pleasant sound. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she said, "this is poetry. You're writing about Heaven's Gate and the caribou herd, but what comes across is loneliness, displacement, angst, and a cynical look at humanity."
"So?"
"So no one wants to pay for a look at another person's angst," laughed Terenna. I turned away from her desk and walked to the far side of the room. Her office took up the entire 435th floor of the Transline Spire in the Babel section of Tau Ceti Center. There were no windows. The circular room was open from floor to ceiling, shielded by a solar-generated containment field, which showed no shimmer whatsoever. It was like standing between two gray plates, suspended halfway between the sky and Earth. I watched crimson clouds move between the lesser spires half a kilometer below, and I thought about hubris. Terenna's office had no doorways, stairways, elevators, field lifts, or trapdoors, no connection to the other levels at all. One entered Terenna's office through the five-faceted farcaster, which shimmered in midair like an abstract holosculpture. I found myself thinking about tower fires and power failures, as well as hubris. I said, "Are you saying that you won't publish it?" "Not at all," smiled my editor. "You've earned Transline several billion marks, Martin. We will publish it. All I'm saying is that no one will buy it." "You're wrong," I shouted. "Not everyone recognizes fine poetry, but there are still enough people who read to make it a bestseller." Terenna did not laugh again, but her smile slashed upward in a twist of green lips. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she said. "The population of literate people has been declining steadily since Gutenberg's day. By the 20th century, less than 2% of the people in the so-called industrialized democracies read even one book a year, and that was before the smart machines, data spheres, and user-friendly environments. By the Hegira, 98% of the hegemony's population had no reason to read anything, so they didn't bother learning how to. It's worse today. There are more than 100 billion human beings in the world web, and less than 1% of them bothers to hard facts any printed material, much less read a book." "The Dying Earth sold almost 3 billion copies," I reminded her. "Mm-hmm," said Terenna. "It was the Pilgrim's Progress effect."
"The what?"
"Pilgrim's Progress effect. In the Massachusetts colony of, what was it, 17th-century Old Earth, every decent family had to have a copy in the household. But my heavens, no one had to read it. It was the same with Hitler's Mein Kampf, or Stukatsky's Visions in the Eye of a Decapitated Child. Who was Hitler, I said.
Terenna smiled slightly.
An old Earth politician who did some writing. Mein Kampf is still in print. Transline renews the copyright every 138 years.
Well, look, I said, I'm going to take a few weeks to polish up the Kantos and give it my best shot.
Fine, smiled Terenna. I suppose you'll want to edit it the way you did last time.
Not at all, said Terenna. Since there's no core of nostalgia this time, you might as well write it the way you want.
I blinked. You mean, I can keep in the blank verse this time?
Of course.
And the philosophy?
Please do.
And the experimental sections?
Yes.
And you'll print it the way I write it?
Absolutely.
Is there a chance it'll sell?
Not a hope in hell.
My few weeks to polish up the Kantos turned into 10 months of obsessive labor. I shut off most of the rooms in the house, keeping only the tower room on Deneb Dry, the exercise room on Lussus, the kitchen, and the bathroom raft on Mare Infinitus. I worked a straight 10 hours a day, took a break for some vigorous exercise, followed by a meal and a nap, and then returned to my writing table for another 8 hour stint. It was similar to the time 5 years before when I was recovering from my stroke, and it sometimes took an hour or a day for a word to come to me, for a concept to sink its roots into the firm soil of language. Now it was an even slower process as I agonized over the perfect word, the precise rhyme scheme, the most playful image, and the most ineffable analog to the most elusive emotion. After 10 standard months I was done, acknowledging the ancient aphorism to the effect that no book or poem is ever finished, merely abandoned.
"What do you think?" I asked Terenna as she read through the first copy.
Her eyes were blank bronze discs in that week's fashion, but this did not hide the fact that there were tears there. She brushed one away.
"It's beautiful," she said.
"I tried to rediscover the voice of some of the ancients," I said, suddenly shy.
"You succeeded brilliantly."
The Heaven's Gate interlude is still rough, I said.
It's perfect.
It's about loneliness, I said.
It is loneliness.
Do you think it's ready, I asked.
It's perfect. A masterpiece.
Do you think it'll sell, I asked.
No fucking way.
They planned an initial run of 70 million hardfax copies of Kantos. Transline ran ads throughout the datasphere, placed HTV commercials, transmitted software inserts, successfully solicited blurbs from best-selling authors, made sure it was reviewed in the new New York Times book section and the TC2 review, and generally spent a fortune on advertising. The Kantos sold 23,000 hardfax copies during the first year it was in print. At 10% royalties of the 12MK cover price, I earned back 13,800 MK of my 2 million MK advance from Transline. The second year saw a sale of 638 hardfax copies. There were no datasphere rights sold, no Holly options, and no book tours. What the Kantos lacked in sales, it made up for in negative reviews. "Indecipherable, archaic, irrelevant to all current concerns," said the Times book section. "M. Silenus has committed the ultimate act of non-communication," wrote Urban Capri in the TC2 review, "by indulging himself in an orgy of pretentious obfuscation." Marmon Hamlet, on AllNet Now, issued the final death blow. Oh, the poetry thing from What's-His-Name. Couldn't read it, didn't try.
Terenna Wingreen Fief did not seem concerned. 2 weeks after the first reviews and hard facts returns came in, a day after my 13-day binge ended, I farcast to her office and threw myself into the black flow foam chair which crouched in the center of the room like a velvet panther. One of Tau Ceti Center's legendary thunderstorms was going on, and Jovian-sized lightning crashes were rending the blood-tinged air just beyond the invisible containment field. "Don't sweat it," said Tyrena. This week's fashions included a hairdo which sent black spikes thrusting half a meter above her forehead, and a body field opacitor which left shifting currents of color concealing and revealing the nudity beneath. The first run only amounted to 60,000 fax transmits, so we're not out much there. "You said 70 million were planned," I said. "Yeah, well, we changed our minds after Transline's resident AI read it." I slumped lower in the flow foam. "Even the AI hated it?" "The AI loved it," said Terenna. "That's when we knew for sure that people were going to hate it." I sat up. "Couldn't we have sold copies to the Technocore?" "We did," said Terenna. "One." "The millions of AIs there probably real-time shared it the minute it came in over Fatline. Interstellar copyright doesn't mean shit when you're dealing with silicon." "All right," I said, slumping. "What next?" Outside, lightning bolts the size of old Earth's ancient superhighways danced between the corporate spires and cloud towers. Terenna rose from her desk and walked to the edge of the carpeted circle. Her body field flickered like electrically charged oil on water. "Next," she said, "you decide if you want to be a writer or the world web's biggest jerk-off."
"What?"
"You heard me." Terenna turned and smiled. Her teeth had been capped to gold points. "The contract allows us to recover the advance in any way we have to. Seizing your assets at Interbank, recovering the gold coins you've got hidden on Homefree, and selling that gaudy Farcaster house would about do it. And then you can go join the other artistic dilettantes and dropouts and mental cases that sad King Billy collects on whatever outback world he lives on." I stared. "Then again," she said, and smiled her cannibal smile, "we can just forget this temporary setback, and you can get to work on your next book." My next book appeared 5 standard months later. The Dying Earth 2 picked up where the Dying Earth left off, in plain prose this time, the sentence length and chapter content carefully guided by neurobio-monitored responses on a test group of 638 average hard facts readers. The book was in novel form, short enough not to intimidate the potential buyer at Food Mart checkout stands, and the cover was a 20-second interactive hollow, wherein the tall, swarthy stranger, Amalfi Schwartz, I suppose, though Amalfi was short and pale and wore corrective lenses, rips the bodice of the struggling female just to the nipple line before the protesting blonde turns toward the viewer and cries for help in a breathless whisper, provided by Porn Holly star Lita Swan. Dying Earth 2 sold 19 million copies.
"Not bad," said Terenna. "It takes a while to build an audience."
"The first Dying Earth sold 3 billion copies," I said. "Pilgrim's Progress," she said. "Mein Kampf. Once in a century. Maybe less."
"But it sold 3 billion.
"Look," said Tyrena. "In 20th century old Earth, a fast food chain took dead cow meat, fried it in grease, added carcinogens, wrapped it in petroleum-based foam, and sold 900 billion units."
"Human beings. Go figure."
Dying Earth 3 introduced the characters of Winona, the escaped slave girl who rose to the ownership of her own fiberplastic plantation—never mind that fiberplastic never grew on old Earth— Arturo Redgrave, the dashing blockade runner. What blockade? An Innocence Sperry, the 9-year-old telepath dying of an unspecified Little Nell disease. Innocence lasted until Dying Earth 9, and on the day Transline allowed me to kill the little shit off, I went out to celebrate with a 6-day, 20-world binge. I awoke in a lung pipe on Heaven's Gate, covered with vomit and rebreather mold, nursing the web's biggest headache and the sure knowledge that I soon would have to start on Volume 10 of The Chronicles of the Dying Earth. It isn't hard being a hack writer. Between Dying Earth 2 and Dying Earth 9, 6 standard years had passed relatively painlessly. My research was meager. My plots, formulaic. My characters, cardboard. My prose, preliterate. And my free time was my own. I traveled. I married twice more. Each wife left me with no hard feelings, but with a sizable portion of the royalties from my next Dying Earth. I explored religions and serious drinking, finding more hope of lasting solace in the latter. I kept my home, adding 6 rooms on 5 worlds, and filled it with fine art. I entertained. Writers were among my acquaintances, but at all times we tended to mistrust and badmouth each other, secretly resenting the other's successes and finding fault in their work. Each of us knew in his or her heart that he or she was a true artist of the word who merely happened to be commercial. The others were hacks. Then, on a cool morning, with my sleeping room rocking slightly in the upper branches of my tree on the Templar world, I awoke to a gray sky and the realization that my muse had fled. It had been 5 years since I had written any poetry. The cantus lay open in the Deneb Dry Tower. Only a few pages finished beyond what had been published. I had been using thought processors to write my novels, and one of these activated as I entered the study. Shit, it printed out. What did I do with my muse? It says something about the type of writing I had been doing, that my muse could flee without my noticing. For those who do not write, and who never have been stirred by the creative urge, talk of muses seems a figure of speech, a quaint conceit. But for those of us who live by the word, our muses are as real and necessary as the soft clay of language which they help to sculpt. When one is writing, really writing, it is as if one is given a fat line to the gods. No true poet has been able to explain the exhilaration one feels when the mind becomes an instrument, as surely as does the pen or thought processor, ordering and expressing the revelations flowing in from somewhere else. My muse had fled. I sought her in the other worlds of my house, but only silence echoed back from the art-bedecked walls and empty spaces. I farcast and flew to my favorite places, watching the suns set on the wind-blown prairies of grass and the night fogs obscure the ebony crags of Nevermore. But although I emptied my mind of the trash prose of the endless dying earth, there came no whispers from my muse. I sought her in alcohol and flashback, returning to the productive days on Heaven's Gate, when her inspiration was a constant buzzing in my ears, interrupting my work, waking me from sleep. But in the relived hours and days, her voice was as muted and garbled as a damaged audio disc from some forgotten century. My muse had fled. I farcast to Terenna Wingreenfief's office at the precise moment of my appointment. Terenna had been promoted from editor-in-chief of the Hard Facts Division to publisher. Her new office occupied the highest level of the Tau Ceti Center Transline Spire, and standing there was like perching on the carpeted summit of the galaxy's tallest, thinnest peak. Only the invisible dome of the slightly polarized containment field arched overhead, and the edge of the carpet ended in a 6-kilometer drop. I wondered if other authors felt the urge to jump.
"The new opus?" said Terenna.
Lussus was dominating the fashion universe this week, and dominate was the right word. My editor was dressed in leather and iron, rusted spikes on her wrists and neck, and a massive bandolier across her shoulder and left breast. The cartridges looked real.
"Yeah?"
I said, and tossed the manuscript box on her desk. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she sighed. "When are you going to transmit your books rather than going to all of the trouble of printing them out and bringing them here in person?" "There's a strange satisfaction in delivering them," I said, "especially this one."
"Oh?"
"Yes," I said. "Why don't you read some of it?" Terenna smiled and clicked black fingernails along the cartridges in her bandolier. "I'm sure it's up to your usual high standards, Martin," she said, "but I don't have to look at it."
"Please, do," I said.
"Really," said Terenna, "there's no reason. It always makes me nervous to read a new work while the author is present."
"This one won't," I said. "Read just the first few pages."
She must have heard something in my voice, because she frowned slightly and opened the box. The frown deepened as she read the first page and flipped through the rest of the manuscript. Page one had a single sentence. "And then, one fine morning in October, the dying earth swallowed its own bowels, spasmed its final spasm, and died." The other 299 pages were blank.
"A joke, Martin?"
"Nope."
"A subtle hint, then?"
"You would like to begin a new series?"
"Nope."
"It's not as if we hadn't expected it, Martin. Our storyliners have come up with several exciting series ideas for you. M. Sabwezi thinks that you would be perfect for the novelizations of the Crimson Avenger Hollies."
"You can stick the Crimson Avenger up your corporate ass, Terenna," I said cordially. "I'm finished with Transline, and this premasticated gruel you call fiction."
Terenna's expression did not flicker. Her teeth were not pointed. Today they were rusted iron to match the spikes on her wrists and the collar around her neck.
"Martin, Martin, Martin," she sighed, "you have no idea how finished you will be if you don't apologize, straighten up, and fly right. But that can wait until tomorrow. Why don't you step home, sober up, and think about this?"
I laughed. "I'm as sober as I've been in 8 years, lady. It just took me a while to realize that it wasn't just me who's writing crap. There's not a book published in the web this year that hasn't been total garbage. Well, I'm getting off the scow."
Terenna rose. For the first time, I noticed that on her simulated canvas web belt there hung a Force death wand. I hoped that it was a designer fake, as the rest of her costume.
"Listen, you miserable no-talent hack," she hissed. "Transline owns you from the balls up. If you give us any more trouble, we'll have you working in the Gothic Romance Factory under the name Rosemary Titmouse. Now go home, sober up, and get to work on Dying Earth 10.
I smiled and shook my head. Terenna squinted slightly.
"You're still into us for almost a million mark advance," she said. "One word to collections, and we'll seize every room of your house except that goddamn raft you use as an outhouse. You can sit on it until the oceans fill up with crap." I laughed a final time. "It's a self-contained disposal unit," I said. "Besides, I sold the house yesterday. The check for the balance of the advance should have been transmitted by now." Terenna tapped the plastic grip of her death wand. "Transline's copyrighted the Dying Earth concept, you know. We'll just have someone else write the books." I nodded. "They're welcome to it." Something in my ex-editor's voice changed when she realized that I was serious. Somewhere, I sensed there was an advantage to her if I stayed.
"Listen," she said, "I'm sure we can work this out, Martin. I was saying to the director the other day that your advances were too small, and that Transline should let you develop a new storyline."
"Terenna, Terenna, Terenna," I sighed. "Goodbye."
I farcast to Renaissance Vector, and then to Parsimony, where I boarded a spinship for the 3-week voyage to Asquith and the crowded kingdom of Sad King Billy. Notes for a sketch of Sad King Billy. His Royal Highness, King William the 23rd, Sovereign Lord of the Kingdom of Windsor in Exile, looks a bit like a wax candle of a man who has been left on a hot stove. His long hair runs in limp rivulets to slumped shoulders, while the furrows on his brow trickle downward to the tributaries of wrinkles around the basset hound eyes, and then run southward again through folds and frown lines to the maze of wattles in neck and jowls. King Billy is said to remind anthropologists of the worry dolls of the outback Kinshasa, to make Zen Gnostics recall the pitiful Buddha after the temple fire on Taizin, and to send media historians rushing to their archives to check photos of an ancient flat-film movie actor named Charles Lawton. None of these references mean anything to me. I look at King Billy and think of my long-dead tutor, Don Balthazar, after a week-long binge. Sad King Billy's reputation for gloominess is exaggerated. He often laughs. It is merely his misfortune that his peculiar form of laughter makes most people think he is sobbing. A man cannot help his physiognomy, but in His Highness's case, the entire persona tends to suggest either buffoon or victim. He dresses, if that can be the word, in something approaching a constant state of anarchy, defying the taste and color sense of his android servants, so that on some days he clashes with himself and his environment simultaneously. Nor is his appearance limited to sartorial chaos. King William moves in a permanent sphere of dishabille, his fly unsealed, his velvet cape torn and tattered, and drawing crumbs magnetically from the floor, his left sleeve ruffle twice as long as the right, which, in turn, looks as if it has been dipped in jam. You get the idea. For all this, Sad King Billy has an insightful mind, and a passion for the arts and literature, which has not been equaled since the true Renaissance days on old, old Earth. In some ways, King Billy is the fat child with his face eternally pressed to the candy store window. He loves and appreciates fine music, but cannot produce it. A connoisseur of ballet and all things graceful, His Highness is a klutz, a moving series of pratfalls and comic bits of clumsiness. A passionate reader, unerring poetry critic, and patron of forensics, King Billy combines a stutter in his verbal expression with a shyness which will not allow him to show his verse or prose to anyone else. A lifelong bachelor, now entering his 60th year, King Billy inhabits the tumble-down palace and 2,000-square-mile kingdom as if it were another suit of rumpled royal clothes. Anecdotes abound. One of the famous oil painters whom King Billy supports finds His Majesty walking head down, hands clasped behind him, one foot on the garden path and one in the mud, obviously lost in thought. The artist hails his patron. Sad King Billy looks up, blinks, looks around as if awakening from a long nap. "Excuse me," His Highness says to the bemused painter, "but could you please tell me, was I headed toward the palace or away from the palace?"
"Toward the palace, Your Majesty," replies the artist.
"Oh, good," sighs the king, "then I've had lunch."
General Horace Glennonhite had begun his rebellion, and the outback world of Asquith lay directly in his path of conquest. Asquith was not worried. The hegemony had offered a force space fleet as a shield, but the royal ruler of the kingdom of Monaco in exile seemed more melted than ever when he called me in.
"Martin," said His Majesty, "you've heard about the battle for Fomalhaut?"
"Yeah," I said. "It doesn't sound like anything to worry about. Fomalhaut was just the kind of place Glennonhite's been hitting. Small, no more than a few thousand colonists, rich in minerals, and with a time debt of at least, what is it, 20 standard months from the web?"
23, said Sad King Billy. "So you don't think that we are in jeopardy?"
"Uh-huh," I said. "With only a 3-week real transit time and a time debt of less than a year, the hegemony can always get forces here from the web faster than the general can spin up from Fomalhaut."
"Perhaps," mused King Billy, beginning to lean on a globe and then jumping upright as it started to turn under his weight. "But nonetheless, I've decided to start our own modest hegira."
I blinked, surprised. Billy had been talking about relocating the kingdom in exile for almost 2 years, but I had never thought he would go through with it.
The ships are ready on Parvati, he said. Asquith has agreed to provide the transport we need to the web.
But the palace, I said, the library, the farms, and the grounds.
Donated, of course, said King Billy. But the contents of the library will travel with us.
I sat on the arm of the horsehair divan and rubbed my cheek. In the 10 years I had been in the kingdom, I had progressed from Billy's subject of patronage to tutor, to confidant, to friend. But never did I pretend to understand this disheveled enigma. Upon my arrival, he had granted me an immediate audience.
Do you wish to join the other talented people in our little colony? He had asked.
Yes, Your Majesty.
And will you write more books like the Dying Earth?
Not if I can help it, Your Majesty.
I read it, you know, the little man had said. It was very interesting.
You're most kind, sir.
B-b-b-bullshit, M. Silenus. It was interesting because someone had obviously Baudelaireized it and left in all the bad parts.
I had grinned, surprised by the sudden revelation that I was going to like Sad King Billy.
But the Cantos, he sighed. That was a book. Probably the finest volume of poetry published in the web in the last 2 centuries. How you managed to get that by the mediocrity police, I will never know. I ordered 20,000 copies for the kingdom.
I bowed my head slightly, at a loss for words for the first time since my post-stroke days 2 decades before.
Will you write more poetry like the Cantos?
I came here to try, Your Majesty.
Then welcome, said Sad King Billy. You will stay in the west wing of the castle, near my offices, and my door will always be open to you.
Now I glanced at the closed door and at the little sovereign, who, even when smiling, looked as if he were on the verge of tears.
Hyperion?
I asked.
He had mentioned the colony world gone primitive many times.
Precisely. The android seed ships have been there for some years, Martin, preparing the way, as it were.
I raised an eyebrow. King Billy's wealth came not from the assets of the kingdom, but from major investments in the web economy. Even so, if he had been carrying on a surreptitious recolonization effort for years, the cost must have been staggering.
Do you remember why the original colonists named the world Hyperion, Martin?
Sure. Before the Hegira, they were a tiny freehold on one of the moons of Saturn. They couldn't last without terrestrial resupply, so they emigrated to the outback and named the survey world after their moon.
King Billy smiled sadly.
And do you know why the name is propitious for our endeavor?
It took me about 10 seconds to make the connection.
Keats, I said.
Several years earlier, near the end of a long discussion about the essence of poetry, King Billy had asked me who was the purest poet who had ever lived.
The purest, I had said. Don't you mean the greatest?
No, no, said Billy. That's absurd to argue over who is the greatest. I'm curious about your opinion of the purest, the closest to the essence you describe.
I had thought about it a few days and then brought my answer to King Billy as we watched the setting suns from the top of the bluff near the palace. Red and blue shadows stretched across the amber lawn toward us.
Keats, I said.
John Keats, whispered sad King Billy. Ah.
And then a moment later, why?
So I had told him what I knew about the 19th-century old earth poet, about his upbringing, training, and early death, but mostly about a life dedicated almost totally to the mysteries and beauties of poetic creation.
Billy had seemed interested then. He seemed obsessed now as he waved his hand and brought into existence a hollow model which all but filled the room. I moved backward, stepping through hills and buildings and grazing animals to get a better view.
"Behold, Hyperion!" whispered my patron.
As was usually the case when he was totally absorbed, King Billy forgot to stutter. The hollow shifted through a series of views. River cities, port cities, mountain areas, a city on a hill filled with monuments to match the strange buildings in the nearby valley.
"The Time Tombs?" I said.
"Precisely. The greatest mystery in the known universe." I frowned at the hyperbole.
"They're fucking empty," I said. "They've been empty since they were discovered.
They are the source of a strange anti-entropic force field which lingers still," said King Billy.
"One of the few phenomena outside singularities which dares to tamper with time itself."
"It's no big deal," I said. "It must have been like painting rust preventative on metal. They were made to last, but they're empty. And since when do we go bug-fuck about technology?"
"Not technology," sighed King Billy, his face melting into deeper grooves. "Mystery. The strangeness of place, so necessary to some creative spirits. A perfect mixture of the classical utopia and the pagan mystery."
I shrugged, not impressed. Sad King Billy waved the hollow away.
"Has your poetry improved?"
I crossed my arms and glared at the regal dwarf slob.
"No."
"Has your muse returned?"
I said nothing.
If looks could have killed, we would all be crying, "The king is dead, long live the king," before nightfall.
"Very well," he said, showing that he could look insufferably smug as well as sad. "Pack your bags, my boy.
We're going to Hyperion.